So I think we're a ways off, to be fair. I think it's going to take a while to get there. People who, that I have a fair bit of respect for that analyze this space, say silver in particular, and commodities and precious metals as well, think that it could be a matter of a couple of years. And frankly, look, I was somewhat wrong in terms of how quickly we would get to triple digits. I didn't think it would come this fast. I like to say, look, it took 45 years to get back to 50, and then it took 3 months to get to 100, right? So what do I know, right? But the sense I have is that we could see triple digits, frankly, again, maybe by the end of this year or at some point next year. That's tough to say.
Good day, everybody. It's your host here, just Steve Yang. I am with NRS World, where we mine for stories that matter, natural resource stocks. I'm here joined by Peter Kroth, one of my heroes, author of The Great Silver Bull, publisher of Silver Stock Investor and Silver Advisor. And he's been investing in precious metals for several decades now. He's one of the clearest voices that I know in the space, and he's been very influential to me. So, Peter, thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Steve. Thank you for having me. And it's a big day in some ways, given the new Fed chair taking over.
Yeah, you've been watching the meeting today?
I have that post-meeting press conference and trying to get a bit of a sense of what kind of leadership that might mean for us going forward. And we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm looking at the price now, just kind of seeing what the announcement did. But Peter, you've been calling a major silver bull market for years now. And we saw silver rip earlier this year to an all-time high of just over $120 before now pulling back to where we are today. Again, from 70, 69, 68, back to maybe 70, we'll see. But has this cycle played out the way you expected? And where do you think we are today?
Yeah, I mean, generally the way I expected, yes. I will admit that, both gold and silver's relentless climb last year surprised me. I did not expect it to be quite as strong and for it to peak temporarily quite as high as it did, silver in particular. So that the degree of that took me by surprise. But, one of the things I've been telling subscribers and people when I do presentations is that I came across, actually it's a former colleague who shared this chart not long ago, and it was a chart of basically of how assets behave generally, in a bull, in a cycle, bull to bear. And what I found interesting is that relatively early on, so the first phase is sort of that stealth phase when just the very, very early money or investors get involved, have, conviction and watch and wait. And it's kind of quiet. Like it doesn't do much. It just rises very slowly. And I think we were through that phase for the last couple of years. And then when we hit sort of early to middle of last year, we moved into the next phase, which is sort of a bit of a what they call, I guess, a smart money phase. We're out of the stealth phase. And what happens is some smart money starts to move in. You could call those different things institutional money or whatever, but, realizing kind of what's starting to happen in this sector. But what happens is you get a kind of an early blow off, and then it pops, and then it corrects significantly. And what's interesting in this chart, which is meant for assets in general, is that whoever created this chart said, what would they call that part? The bear trap. So after that first kind of pretty significant correction, people who got in late that, okay, that's it. This bull market is over. It's never going back to these previous highs. Right. Yeah. I see you're laughing there, Steve. I think you're thinking the same thing I'm thinking, but what happens is, so, a lot of these sort of latecomers think, that's it, it's over, and they'll never come back. They maybe bought in at $80, $90, $100. They see it go to 60, they sell, they've been burned, and they're out. And right.
Yeah,
so that's unfortunate. It really is, because I think there's a long way for it still to go. But then you start a really long, much more sort of intense climb after that correction, after that bear trap correction. And where I think things differ for silver versus the chart that I had, is that, that rise is pretty, I guess, quick. You could call it a few years or whatever. I actually think it's going to be several years for that rise to. It's not going to happen without volatility and further peaks and big corrections. But I think ultimately it's going to get that part of it's going to stretch out much farther going forward.
Peter, a few years ago, $300 silver sounded outrageous to some. Today, more people are taking the idea much more seriously. Does that $300 target feel more like a someday number to you, or are we actually closer to that than people realize? And what does that climb look like if in terms of phases? I mean, I know you mentioned it's a long period, but how close are we to that 300?
So I think we're a ways off, to be fair. I think it's going to take a while to get there. People who, that I have a fair bit of respect for that analyze this space, say silver in particular, and commodities and precious metals as well, think that it could be a matter of a couple of years. And frankly, look, I was somewhat wrong in terms of how quickly we would get to triple digits. I didn't think it would come this fast. I like to say, look, it took 45 years to get back to 50, and then it took 3 months to get to 100, right? So what do I know, right? But the sense I have is that we could see triple digits, frankly, again, maybe by the end of this year or at some point next year. That's tough to say. And then we could see, my top target of about right now, at least for now, I'm going to willing to say that maybe it'll go higher eventually. I'm willing to adjust, but for now, my top target eventually is going to be, say, 300. And look, I was surprised how quickly this happened. Maybe it is going to be a couple of years. That's what I'm hearing some pretty, bright minds saying that we could see it that quickly. But frankly, my sense is that it's going to take longer than that. It could be more like maybe 4, 5, 6 years till we ultimately see that kind of a number. And to be fair, for some of industry that relies on silver significantly, that's going to have a big impact. That's going to really hurt. We've heard all sorts of stories about how the solar panel industry is having to readjust at, $80, $90, $100. So we're back at 60, 70. Frankly, that's a lot more manageable than we think it is for them. It really is. And we can talk about, what this war in the Middle East has done and how that's actually been very, very stimulative for demand for solar panels. But I mean, even at these higher prices, don't there all sorts of things can happen, and I can elaborate on all of them. Why that could remain very supportive for silver and for one of its biggest consumers, which is the solar panel industry.
So silver, as I understand it, is has been known as the poor man's gold. As it becomes more industrialized, is that the whole money aspect going to fade away eventually? Is that coming sooner than we think? And as the industrial side increases, in terms of supply and demand, are we typically underestimating the demand? Are we overestimating how quickly supply can respond? I mean, like, what's driving this price forward or up?
Yeah, so the first part of your question about it being money, I think that's going to just ebb and flow a lot. You're right. There's a really interesting stat. If you look at, so call the silver market 1 billion ounces a year, right? So that's essentially what we produce between mining and recycling, about 1 billion ounces. We consume a little bit more, actually. So we've been in deficit for the last 4 or 5 years. But despite that, what's interesting is how much industry has taken on in terms of importance within that demand on the demand side. And 5 years ago, industry was 50%. Last year, it was about 65%. So it's gone up by a third. And here's the, I think, the key part. That means that 5 years ago, the other 50% was in some form available for for investment purposes. And I lump together silverware, jewelry, and coins and bars that people buy for investment as all of it as investment, just for
Etc.
simplicity. Exactly. And so if you fast forward from 5 years ago to last year, now you've gone from half of silver being available for investment to now about only a third of silver being available for investment. So what does that do? Well, I think we have a perfect example of what it does. The end of last year and into early this year, when people want to buy it as money because they see gold going from 3 to 4 to 5,000, and they think, oh my God, gold is not backing off. This is going to continue. There are all sorts of reasons why I need to own some gold. Gold's gotten crazy expensive now. What alternatives do I have? And silver has always been that alternative when it comes to money. And by the way, historically, silver has probably been responsible for more transactions globally than gold has, just because silver's a day-to-day money, right? It's been used to, as I say, for daily transactions to buy small things. People could in the past go out and do groceries and pay for, small cost services, all sorts of things.
Are we
So,
talking about the history of mankind or
yeah.
just recently?
No, history period. Yeah, history of mankind. It's thought that silver is responsible for more transactions globally historically than gold is, simply because gold has a higher value for a small, per unit, right? So you'd read it, you'd basically need a tiny piece of gold, right, to go out and buy a loaf of bread or a carton of milk, for example. And that's not true for silver. So anyways, that aside, I think, like I say, the money side of it ebbs and flows. What we've seen is industrial demand is picking up. That's squeezing out the available silver for investment. But when it does come in, that just causes a squeeze because there's less silver available. And I think that contributed to the squeeze that we had at the end of last year and into early this year. I'm trying to remember, what was the second part of your question?
Well, you mentioned solar panels. What's the driver that people are underestimating right now?
There's been so much talk really about, because of much higher silver prices, that we're gonna see manufacturers move towards things like copper, use copper pastes. They're going to, there are so many things around that. I'm not here to say this is not going to happen. Maybe it is going to happen, but there are big challenges for that. First of all, it's very costly to retool these massive manufacturing facilities. There's huge capital investments. You have to shut down for weeks or months to bring in new equipment. You have to train people. The copper does not last as long as the silver does. It's not as efficient. It'll corrode sooner. Again, I can go on and on, but there are all sorts of reasons why, people will prefer silver. It's longer lasting, it's more efficient, and it's proven, right? So there's a really interesting stat, and this is not to compare it to copper, but I came across this. This was Ember Research that put this out, and what they were saying is, let's say you have $100 million and you need to generate 1.5 terawatts of energy for a year. Well, you can go out and buy natural gas. Natural gas will do that. Or you can take that same $100 million and you can buy solar panels. Those solar panels will also generate 1.5 terawatts of energy, but it'll do it every year for 25 years. So natural gas or for 1 year, or solar panels for 25 years for the same cost. And these are the silver solar panels. So, with the war we've been experiencing in the Middle East, people, and to go back for a second, we were thinking and hearing about how the demand for solar may drop off because of the price of silver and substitutes coming online. Well, I can tell you that the initial reaction was soaring demand for solar panels. People looked at high price gasoline, high price heating oil, and they said, wow, like, what are my alternatives? I don't want to deal with this. So there's this the largest electricity provider in the UK is called Octopus Energy, and they saw that in the months of February and March, demand for, because they sell solar panels, demand jumped by basically doubled month over month for 2 months. China in the month of, I believe it was April, saw their sales of solar panels almost double over the prior month. So people have been flocking to solar panels as an alternative to, high oil and high gasoline cost. You've got all kinds of countries that are encouraging people to use EVs instead of their ICE engine cars. And I'm of the opinion that, this was a big shock. Actually, the guy who's behind the International Energy Agency, the director, Fatih Birol, he said that we're facing the biggest energy security threat in history when we had this shock from the in the Middle East with Iran-US confrontation. And so I'm convinced that you've got all sorts of players, sovereign players, large manufacturers, anyone who relies on energy. And by the way, there are countries out there, some very, very first world developed countries that rely 70, 80, 90% on their oil from the Middle East. It's just incredible, right? So they can't be without. These are big manufacturing economies. You can bet, Steve, that they're looking at alternatives. They're looking at not just, I'm not just talking about solar panels, but in general, they're looking at globally, how do we make sure that we're not shocked like this for energy in the future, right? I mean, this is terrible for them to deal with. You can bet that they're looking for alternatives in terms of onshoring or what we call friendshoring, looking for suppliers that they call quote unquote more friendly, either closer by or more reliable, or whose oil doesn't come through the Strait of Hormuz, all these kinds of things. And I don't know about you, but I can tell you if I'm in charge of some huge company that manufactures things that relies on diesel, for example, or plastics that are derivatives of oil. And this is wreaking havoc on my planning and on my costs. I'm going to look at suppliers that will say, "All right, I can guarantee you your supply. I'm going to have to charge you more, but let's say for the next 3 years or 5 years, you're going to have this supply. It's going to cost you more, but it's reliable." And so that's a much easier way to do business. And they might absorb those higher prices for a little while, but they're going to start passing them on. So it's very inflationary. And I'm willing to bet that to some degree, solar panels have a role in some of that as well.
Here, my understanding with mines, especially if they've been undermined for years, I mean, it's not like you could just turn the spigot back on. It's like you got, everyone says, higher prices solves, supply shortages. If you can expand on a little bit more why that might not be the case for silver and how it works and just the lag time that it might take.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. And that's especially true for silver because silver is, unlike many other metals, 75% of it is a byproduct. So of the mined silver every year, only about 25% of it comes from what we call primary silver mines that mostly produce silver. The other 75% comes from mines that produce silver as a byproduct. So silver is not their main product. They're producing gold or copper or lead and zinc. So imagine that it's the case. 75% of silver comes from those mines. So they don't care if the silver price moves up. I mean, they're happy to take a higher silver price, but they're not going to try, even try, not that it's easy, but they're not going to try and produce more metal to therefore produce more silver, just because the silver price went up. This is usually a small part of their revenue stream. So some of them don't even report the silver revenues. It's so small, right? But again, they're happy to take that higher price. So they one so so we like to say that silver supply is price inelastic. And in fact, you've got some, if you look at the primary silver miners that where silver is the main product, they may look at higher silver prices and say, heck, I can silver's so much higher now. It's double, let's say, what it was last year. And if they have the flexibility to mine from an area of the deposit that is lower grade and make the same profit or more than they did at lower silver prices, but produce even less silver, they'll do it. So that could actually exacerbate things and bring less silver to market. And we haven't even talked about how difficult it is to ramp up a mine. So all this stuff is, has to go through permitting. If you operate at 1,000 tons a day and you want to expand to 1,200 tons or 1,500 tons per day, you've got to get permission for these things. There's a time lag. Sometimes the answer is no. I don't think necessarily that often, but sometimes the answer is no, or you've got to go back to the drawing board and rework some of your environmental data and so on. So there's at the very least there's a lag to that. The numbers I've seen from discovery of an economic deposit to actually breaking ground and having built and start actually producing silver is typically up to at least 10 to more like 15 years. So if you
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. The last time the highest
Even worse than
amount,
I thought.
yeah, it's crazy. The highest amount of silver we've ever produced was in 2016. It was 900 million ounces from mining. We've not been above about 840 million ounces per year ever since. And yet demand has just soared since the lot over the last 10 years. But we're actually not producing more mined silver. We're producing less than we did 10 years ago. So one is that is an inability or a lack of interest in reacting, right? And frankly, the price hasn't been high enough either to encourage more production. And I think that the price hasn't been high enough because there's been, prior to say about 2020 or so, we've been producing a bit more silver than we consumed, so a lot of that ended up, in it was bought by investors, but a lot of it ended up on these futures exchanges, and so it just got pushed into inventories and it piled up, and then when we shifted into a deficit, in other words, say 2020, when we started actually consuming more silver than we were producing, it was easy for these big consumers to just go to these exchanges and start buying it there and drawing it down. That put zero pressure on bringing new silver to market. You're just going and buying from a stockpile. So once that, but the key is that once that stockpile draws down and gets critically low, then price reacts. And that's exactly, I mean, I said this 2.5 years ago in January of 2024. That's what I was saying we should expect to start happening. I said 12 to 18 months of this, and then it's game over. And then by the early part of middle of last year, we started to see the price rise significantly. And that's essentially how it ended up playing out.
Peter, let's say someone buys your silver thesis. What does a sensible silver bucket look like? How would you split between physical metals, ETFs, majors, juniors? And I would love to get your thoughts on maybe junior companies that you like and how you separate the winners from the pretenders,
Sure.
because there aren't very many good. It's hard to find a company, even though it says silver in the name, where it's actually a majority silver company. But how do you filter those out? And if you can kind of give me some tips on what to look for.
Sure. So, the way I split the pie is I say 10% physical and then 50% ETFs slash majors. And the majors can be, there's really one big player in terms of royalty companies, and it's Wheaton Precious Metals. So in other words, ETFs, majors, and large royalty company would be 50%. And then you've got 20% that would go to mid-tiers. So that's sort of mid-sized, small to mid-sized producers. And then another 20% to junior explorers. And that's how I would split that pie. I'm not, giving advice. I'm saying how I do things. And then, you're right, absolutely. There are way too many companies out there that have silver in their name, but when you actually drill down and do the research and look, I mean, silver may represent 15, 20% of what they actually have. And I just find that disingenuous. When I started my newsletter, I said, okay, if this is a silver newsletter, you have to have silver. You gotta have silver, right? Like that sounds reasonable. And so when I looked more closely at how these companies, what they actually have, I felt I was being pretty generous. And I said, actually, it's gotta be at least sort of in the range of 40% silver to kind of start calling them a silver company. I'm willing to go a little bit below that if gold makes up, a significant portion of the balance of the metals, to at least push it over to 40, 45 or so. But filters, the first one is that it's got to be in the range of 40%. And then I think that if people have followed this space, I agree with most of the existing what I call wisdom, at least, is that people are key. And frankly, people, you want to look for people who have a history of successes. Likely they're going to be successful again. Likely they're going to surround themselves with other successful people and people who can get the job done. Likely they're going to pick projects that have the ability to become successful. They're going to be able to get them permitted and grow them and so on. Frankly, I'd rather back a team that has had prior successes and really has done serially, a great job in with prior companies and prior projects, and go with them, even if I think that they have a suboptimal project because I know they've pulled it off before, rather than what looks like the absolute best project but has a sort of mediocre team, because it's a minefield, and chances are they may make some important missteps. So those are the ways that I try to filter. You want to look at capital structure. You don't want too many shares out. You certainly want a decent amount of cash or the ability to raise cash when it's necessary. And a good communication strategy, because I think that's important too. You can have all the best people, project, cap structure, cash position, et cetera, but if you can't communicate that story to the market, it's going to take a while for people to catch on. So that's certainly an important part of the puzzle.
Peter, about jurisdiction, do you have favorites? Do you have n n ones you won't touch? And then if you can share maybe a couple silver stocks that you can share without giving too much away. And then if you can tell us a little bit more about Silver Stock Investor and Silver Stock Advisor and what that's all about.
Sure. So, actually, interestingly enough, when it comes to jurisdictions, they have it's expanded for me in the last, I'm going to say, maybe year or so. I used to, for example, I used to shy away significantly from Bolivia, and there's been a lot of places in Latin America. Interestingly enough, that's where a lot of the silver is. Have shifted to the right. Significantly, and so they have policy. They have people running the country. They have policies, or at least the communication towards policies that are more friendly towards mining and towards open markets. Bolivia, I think, was less that way. In the last few years, has significantly changed, and so. What I really like about, and one of the reasons I'm mentioning Bolivia so much, is that that's been the case, or had been the case, for a long time. I'm going to say maybe 15, 20 years. And because of that, it's very underexplored. I'm keen on Bolivian silver plays, frankly, because that's a place where there's a lot of silver. Very few people have been looking for it. And yet now you've been able to operate. If you were big, I think for the most part, you've been able to operate there pretty well. But I think that now for the explorers, it's become a lot easier. So there's some really interesting plays there. I like Chile that has shifted right. Argentina is an obvious one as well. Colombia is, I think, on the verge of perhaps a new leadership, new administration. That's one I'm kind of watching closely. Peru is, I'm going to say, in the middle right now. There are some changes coming there as well, I believe. I'm going to have to kind of watch that one and see it play out. What I will say in a lot of these places, is that if you have a company that has, sort of existing long-running operations, that has been able to do that safely, securely, smoothly, dealing with governments and dealing with, the local population, all the sort of stakeholders, then jurisdiction remains important, but it takes it takes on a little bit less importance because, you know, that company has been able to demonstrate that maybe even in a bit of a generally more challenging environment that they've been able to pull it off. So, I mean, again, you know, I like to say go where the silver is, but be careful. And if you look at a map, I mean, I want to just sort of throw in this last point. You know, when I started focusing on silver a lot, looking at maps and looking where projects are, there's some silver in Australia. There's a little bit in Europe. Most of it is in Poland, a little bit in Germany. You know, nothing really that significant. Poland, yes, definitely. There's some in Russia. That's a difficult place to operate as obviously right now. And frankly, besides that, you've got in Africa, you've got Morocco that I know of. There's Aya Silver. You were asking about names. Aya Gold and Silver. That's a really good one. And besides that, you basically look at the Americas. If you take a step back and you look at a map of the Americas, so all the way from, say, Alaska, all the way down to Argentina and Chile, everything, almost all the silver is on the left. It's all along that whole mountain range, the Andes, the Rockies, and way up through to Alaska. So that's where most of the silver is. So those are the jurisdictions that are interesting: Alaska, BC, Idaho, Nevada, and then you've got you know, sort of the western part of Mexico, and then the western part of South America as well. So yeah, I mean, and to your last question in terms
Wait,
of sorry.
what was your silver pick again?
That was Aya Gold and Silver.
And what did you like about them?
Well, they have been operating for several years in Morocco. They were very much a first mover in Morocco. I thought that was quite key, actually. The mining industry only opened up about a decade or 15 years ago, you know, more broadly in Morocco. And they, as I say, have been a first mover. They have a producing mine that is over 5 million ounces of silver. It's a very, very rare, large silver-only mine. I mean, there's some minor other things, but essentially it's a silver mine. You very, very rarely find that. And they went through a big expansion that was completed at the end of last year. So they're essentially tripling or quadrupling, have been able to triple or quadruple their output. So it's become a cash machine. And just a little bit farther east in Morocco, this is in what we call the Atlas Mountain Range. They have a second big project. So the first one's called Zgounder, and the second one is called Boumadine. And Boumadine is more of a polymetallic project. So there's a fair bit of silver. If you take silver equivalents, which we talked about earlier, you know, you really want the silver, but still, there's in silver equivalents, we're talking about over 400 million ounces of silver, which is very big. They just are pounding the ground, drilling huge amounts of numbers of meters, actually on both projects, to prove out the size of this and that at the operating mine as well. But there's a lot to like, and they actually just got added to the GDX ETF, which is pretty significant as well. And that should drive some demand for the shares as you've got index followers, you know, looking to take that on.
And that's OTCQX as well as a TSX as well,
Actually, they're on the
and
Nasdaq.
AYA.
About
They're
a
on the
about
NASDAQ. They're on the NASDAQ.
yeah, but they're on the Nasdaq about a month and a half ago. They listed there, so that's actually a little bit of a rarity too. Very interesting in terms of, you know, exposure to U.S. investors. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I've certainly been telling the companies that I talk to and deal with, look, get yourself an OTC listing. That's going to open up a lot of money towards you, and I think that's key. You know, the US is a big market. People are willing to invest. They're willing to they're open-minded. They're willing to take on risk. These juniors, at least in particular, are certainly risk. There's a fair bit of risk, and so that there's a lot of risk money. So at least having a US OTC listing will open up tremendously for you as an operator. So I've been seeing that happen more and more, and there are ways that companies can do it. There are versions, I guess, if you want to call it, of the OTC that are pretty accessible. And so, again, that I think that's important. But bigger players like Aya are listing on NASDAQ. There's a couple of other names I know of that are working on doing the same thing. I can't say who that is, but I just see more and more recognition. That's a place to be listed, and that's going to be big money flowing into some names, and it's gonna have an impact.
Well, Peter, I always learn so much from you. Thank you for the Aya name. I enjoy it, but I do want people to know where to find you. And if you can tell us a little bit more about Silverstock Investor, Silverstock Advisor, and how people can benefit from your services and socials.
Sure, thanks. So I'm easily accessible. I'm on X. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there. I'm pretty active there. So the paid newsletter is Silverstock Investor, and the free letter is Silver Advisor. And Silverstock Investor, Silver Advisor, we have a portal site. So I have an associate, Jeff Clark. He runs a couple of comparable newsletters as well, focused more on gold, copper, uranium. But our portal site is thegoldadvisor.com. You can find our newsletters there, and you can subscribe there as well. If people want an intro to the silver sector, I recommend my book, which talks about everything from the history of silver to economics, generally, the market, the supply demand fundamentals for silver, how you can and get invested in silver, and ultimately how and when to take profits and to sell. Steve, this is going to be, I think, a bull market for the record books. That's why I'm talking about $300 silver. Frankly, people that I have a lot of respect for are talking about even higher numbers, and they're making me look pretty conservative, frankly, at $300 silver.
Yeah,
So,
I've
who
heard some
knows?
outrageous numbers myself.
Yeah,
Four
absolutely.
digits or five
Yeah.
digits.
Oh, I haven't heard those, but I'll keep my eyes open and my ears open. Yeah, for sure. But, frankly, I think this is going to be a bull market for the record books. So you want to participate. You don't have to take huge risk. You can buy physical. You can buy some of the larger producers. Some of these names like Pan American and Wheaton Precious Metals, multi-billion-dollar operators today, were up 16 times in the 2000s. Pan American was up 16 times. I think it was from 2005 to 2000. Eight. Wheaton was up between 2008, 2011, something like that. Again, 16 times. These are some of the largest public silver companies you can be invested in. And they've performed fantastically. So again, don't shy away. It's a space that has risk. It's volatile, but I say, use the volatility to your advantage. Buy when people are going crazy over it, like they were back in January. I was warning, look, we're due for a correction. Look for 40%, 50%, and within days it went from 120 to s high 60s. So the best thing I can say in terms of having confidence in silver at this point in time is how it has behaved since it corrected. I mean, what was to stop it from going from 120 back to 30? You tell me. I mean, it didn't. It went to the high 60s. It went to 70. It's even gone back to over 90 since it corrected to the 60s, in February. But we've been in for give or take about $60 to $70 range, and to me that is one of the most important points. One of my subscribers sent me a really interesting bit of research pointing out that, how the market typically reacts and plays out is that it needs several quarters, typically 3 to 4 quarters of these sustained higher prices, so that the analysts will start to model their projections with the new higher prices. Investors, especially big money, has to start to see, oh, okay, so it's going to stay at $60, $70 at least, and so now these profit ranges that are being reported are not just a one-off quarter, but it's actually 2 quarters, 3 quarters, 4 quarters in a row, and then you've got that conviction. And so once that conviction sets in, then people start to move into these names and say, wow, these are cash machines. I want to point out a really, really interesting stat, and that is that the primary silver miners at $12. Now, because many of them have managed actually to keep their production costs pretty low, all-in sustaining cost was about $12. At about $80 or $90 silver, you're looking at 85% profit margins. It's just completely off the charts. And I'm going to sneak in one other one, and that is that if you look at the S&P, for example, and all the different sectors, and you take the 50 largest gold and silver producers as a group, their profit margins are 31%. The next closest sectors are tech and I'm trying to remember. I can pull this up actually. The next two closest sectors were tech and financials at 17%. So
Wow.
close to double from the largest precious metals and metals miners on the S&P. These are cash machines right now. It's only a matter of a little bit of time before the big money catches on and really starts to rotate into this sector.
Peter, once again, you want to let people know publicly that your book, The Great Silver Bull, was very influential to me. Thank you for writing that and getting my appetite for silver where it is. So thank you for that. Everyone listening, I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from great people like Peter Kroth. I'll be putting Peter's socials inside the show notes. Check those out. Everyone stay smart, curious, disciplined. Be like Peter. Thanks, Peter.
Pleasure, Steve. Thanks, and looking forward to chatting again.